Kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Webber Training Teleclass Lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to once again introduce another of the Webber Training South Pacific Teleclass Series. I'd like to acknowledge the generous support of BD for this lecture. As you're probably all aware, the Webber Teleclasses rely very much on the support of corporate sponsors in order to make this high quality education accessible across the globe. So we're very grateful to BD for their support today. So thank you very much for that. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker today from the Northern Queensland, Australia, Claire Boardman. Claire has an impressive infection control background with 17 years experience in both public and private health sectors and is currently employed as the District Infection Control Consultant for the Torres Strait and Northern Peninsula areas as far north as Queensland. So quite a big job there. Her prior appointments include the Healthcare Associated Infection Surveillance Coordinating Centre in Victoria, the Royal Melbourne Hospital, and several projects for Human Services Victoria and the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare. Claire is the current National President of ACA, which is why she's been so busy recently with the ACA conference, and she holds qualifications in nursing, infection control, and public health. She's an adjunct on Griffith University and the program coordinator for the ACA-run course in infection control. So some very impressive credentials there, Claire. She currently sits on several steering committees of the Commission and is committed to improving health outcomes for patients through enhanced professional standards for Australian ICPs. Welcome, Claire, and thank you very much for agreeing to be a speaker for Webber Training Teleclass on your chosen topic of infection control in the tropics, Notes from a Dinghy.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Jane. Perhaps if I can just give a little bit of introduction as to what I'm doing up here. I'm originally from Melbourne, and Melbourne, for those of you who don't know, is right down in the southern part of Australia. I decided at the end of last year, after visiting Vanuatu and some of the outer islands, after going back to Melbourne, what on earth am I doing in this big city that I had grown up in, been to school in, and worked in? So myself and my family, we made the big move, which is about 5,500 kilometres away from Melbourne up to the very northern tip of Queensland. It in fact is not on the mainland of Australia. We live in the Torres Strait and it's a very geographically isolated district, but we still have the same sort of mod cons that the rest of Australia does, which is a huge benefit. The title of my talk is Infection Control in the Tropics. You'll see from the discussion that I hope to have with you that it's also focusing on some of the public health issues throughout the district. The subtitle is Notes from a Dinghy. For those of you who are in Australia, but also those who have worked in remote locations surrounded by water, the most common means of transport is a dinghy. You get in a tinny, and it's known as a TI, or a Thursday Island tinny, and you go off to the various islands. In my work capacity, though, I fly out to the different islands, of which there's 14 that I visit that are inhabited and have a primary health centre on. And I also go via ferry to the mainland, so there's quite a bit of travel that's involved. I'm just going to move on to the next slide. The objectives for this session is to discuss some of the barriers affecting infection control programs in remote settings and to review some of the available data on hospital-acquired infections in this particular setting. Also to discuss the impact of some of the cultural differences on staff education and the implementation of an effective infection control program, which at times is fraught with difficulty, and I'll aim to address some of those issues later in the session. Also describing how to survive the challenges of living and working in a remote location. As I mentioned, it's geographically isolated, but we still have all the mod cons that are available to us. But by far and large, one of the biggest challenges is you must require a sense of humour. Colloquially, it's known as TI time or coconut time up here. I came from Melbourne, which was a very busy environment. I worked for a state coordinating centre where I had 32 hospitals. So I have gone to a health district now that has 22 sites, but a very different pace of life. And it's important that for anyone working in these particular areas that they have consideration for the fact that they need to slow down and go at the same pace as everybody else. It normally takes about 3 months to adjust to living and working in this sort of environment. I also aim to review some of the data on key public health issues in the Torres Strait, such as MDR-TB and some of the multi-resistant gram-negative organisms. And to also understand the impact of an Australian or Queensland and Northern Territory initiative of Bridging the Gap, which is looking at health equality in Indigenous populations. A little bit of background, for those of you that have moved on to the next slide, you can see down the left-hand corner Australia, and then the area that's highlighted in red is Queensland, and I'm actually off the mainland, as I mentioned. So the Northern Peninsula area is the site that surrounds Bamiga, and there's 2,000 Indigenous people spread over five communities, 750 of which live in Bamiga. There's five Indigenous communities on the Cape, and that includes Injinu, Yimajiko, Yimapoon, Seja, Bamiga. So five primary health centres and one hospital, Bamiga Hospital, that serves the population with 10 beds and two emergency beds. Routinely, hospital admission to Thursday Island Hospital will come through Bamiga Hospital, where patients require high-level care. And that's usually done through Medivac, so via choppers and also Royal Flying Doctor Service. We are quite isolated in some respects, with Cairns being the local referral hospital, which is some 850k away. It may not sound too far, but it's quite difficult to get a plane off the island. We have three plane services a day, which are always full, and for those requiring emergency care, they're usually evacuated via chopper or a commercially chartered plane. Of the five Indigenous communities, it's worth mentioning that three of those are Aboriginal communities, two of those are Torres Strait Islander communities. The Torres Strait Islanders are very quick to point out that there is a difference between Aboriginal communities and Torres Strait Islanders. The Torres Strait Islander community has always belonged on the islands surrounding the northern tip of Queensland, and PNG is our closest neighbour up here, or Papua New Guinea. The differences for Torres Strait Islanders and Aboriginal communities can be seen when you visit their community. Predominantly I work with Torres Strait Islanders, but it's important to mention that because the sorts of strategies that we need to employ for educating health workers, there's inherent differences in each population. So it's important that we recognise and understand which population we're talking to and which measures we're trying to implement, and make sure that we work quite closely with those individual communities to affect better patient outcomes. Just moving on to the next slide. The population of Thursday Island is presently where I'm based, where I live and work most of the time. It's the administrative hub for over 20 islands, of which there's 25,000 inhabitants throughout the Torres Strait. About 3,500 people live on TI, but these figures are a bit rubbery. The reason being is that much of the population migrates further south, down to Cairns, for better work opportunities and training and schooling, and they may or may not then come back to the district, back to their homeland. On TI itself, there's a primary health centre which operates a GP service and lots of health promotion programs. It's staffed by about 60 different staff and about 12 to 14, I think it is, different health programs. At TI Hospital here, we have 26 beds and two wards, and predominantly that's maternity and a general ward, but we also have an operating suite that's quite busy. We run an emergency service 24 hours a day, and there's general medicine and high dependency unit. The paediatrics unit also is very full most of the time, and again, the closest referral hospital for us is 850 k's away. Moving on to the next slide. So this is illustrating the very top of Queensland and the Outer Islands. So the distribution of the islands is around 2,000 k for the district. In the next 2 weeks, I'll actually be travelling out to all of these islands in and out in each day and visiting the primary health centres. The red line that's at the top of the slide indicates the Torres Treaty Zone. And what that means is that Papua New Guinean nationals are able to come down to Boigu Island and Saibai and also Dewan and trade. There's also various programs that they can be involved in, cultural programs, but by and large, the majority of PNG nationals that come to Saibai Island are seeking health care that is not provided within the constraints of the PNG medical service. The main language for the islands is Creole. It's got nothing to do with New Orleans, but it's called Creole. However, each island also has its own dialect, so there's different variations. So even when you think you're getting your Creole right, they will come up with a different interpretation for that particular island. A little bit more background. The employees come from a variety of different settings. Predominantly, they do come from Queensland. We work for Queensland Health, and there's 650 employees throughout the health service. It consists predominantly of the senior medical officers that have skills in anaesthetics, surgery, obs and gynae, and GPs. We also have a fair complement of midwives and nurses working here, and health workers, allied health, support staff and administration. The domains that are highlighted with the asterisks beside them indicate a high turnover, and this provides a particular challenge for infection prevention, not just myself but for others, because of the high turnover of staff coming to the area. Accommodation is a very big issue throughout this region, so even though we have recognised deficits in our health service programs, we can't bring people up from the mainland if there's no accommodation for them. So nurses tend to work on a contract of usually 3 to 6 months, as do the midwives, and the SMOs might come anywhere from 3 months to 2 years. In that respect, there's similarities between here and tertiary institutions, and the types of education that we're trying to target a workforce that's quite mobile. One of the important initiatives from Queensland Government is the Making Tracks, or Toward Closing the Gap in Health Outcomes for Indigenous Queenslanders by 2033. So in terms of measuring performance, there's key things that we look at throughout the district, and this is very similar to the Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. By way of a healthy start to life, so ensuring that there is adequate perinatal care and reduced infant mortality rates. In the Torres, their birth weights are reasonable, but there is high rates of smoking in pregnancy and also alcohol intake. The aim of the health service provision here is to provide at least 5 or more antenatal visits, and that care is usually provided by midwives. We also look at hearing loss in children, and there is a big deficit in the hearing of some of the Indigenous kids, and we have a deadly ears program. Now, deadly in the northern part of Queensland and Northern Territory actually means good. So any program that has deadly before it means good program. So the islanders will tell you, oh, that's really deadly, or that's a really deadly outcome, sister. And what they're saying really is complimentary, that it's great, whatever it is that you're doing, that you're deadly. We do have a number of complications regarding child health checks and also with teenage births, and I'll talk a bit more about how that affects our cesarean section rates as I move through the talk. Risk factors for the population up here, I haven't got any firm figures, but smoking rates are very high in this particular community, and there is also very high rates of risky alcohol consumption. In addition to that, we have many oral health issues. It would be fair to say that children sort of from the age of 4 or 5 are booked in for extractions, which is quite disappointing and sad to see. So we have generations of children now that previously might have had very good oral health in the family home, but because of the introduction of sweets, lollies, soft drinks, and those sorts of foodstuffs that are now being consumed versus the traditional foods that may have been consumed, we're seeing very high rates of dental caries and extraction is required. From an infection prevention perspective and from a public health perspective, that sets up potential problems for disease transmission because many of the children present with abscesses in their teeth and they can go on to develop other diseases such as group A strep infections, which I'll come to later in the talk. So good oral health is paramount for the children that are coming through the healthcare system. We also aim to improve adult health checks. However, as part of the closing of the gap, it's all very well to do adult health checks, but it's then what you do with that information. So we aim to target a lot of the surveillance that is done and to put in interventions so that we are actually seeing significant gains in the health of the population. But it will take probably 1 to 2 generations before we see any success. It's too early to tell at this present moment. So moving on to some of the communicable diseases that we see, this is just taken from one of my surveillance reports, and the diseases that are highlighted with an asterisk are the ones that we see most commonly. And you might be interested to note that gastrointestinal infections, for example, typhoid, salmonella and shigella, at least salmonella and shigella is quite common also in metropolitan and other remote settings. Less common though is cholera and hep A. We do see a number of patients that come through PNG, down through that island of Saibai that I mentioned that is right at the top of the Torres, and they come down seeking health care and they're admitted to the TI hospital for treatment. It does pose a number of infection prevention issues, not so much the transmission issues, but regarding staff information and lack of information. And it's often a challenge to provide good quality advice on a recurring basis on the same issue to a rotating and fluctuating workforce. No sooner have you educated a group of healthcare professionals than they've moved on to the next agency contract. So it's quite difficult to implement some of the programs and retain some of the knowledge when it's lost with each change in staffing. We also see quite high rates of bloodborne disease, not so much through the Torres, but again in our neighbours, PNG nationals that are seeking healthcare in Australia. It is quite common for PNG nationals to present with tuberculosis, open pulmonary TB that has been untreated, or in some instances an ad hoc treatment regime has been in place and they've developed multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. Often these patients attending Thursdale and hospital have comorbidities and underlying bloodborne disease. So they might present in a very poor state of health with open pulmonary TB, which is their primary diagnosis, but in addition to that, they have hepatitis B, HIV and hepatitis C. There's some important considerations for vector-borne disease. Now, not so much in the hospital, and I would think that it would happen in the hospital, but from a Japanese encephalitis perspective, given the nature of the climate up here and also dengue and malaria, we do have outbreaks of dengue. So we've had six cases confirmed in the last 6 weeks in northern Queensland, and it's very much seasonal. I'll talk a little bit about the weather later. Why this poses a particular problem is because we have remote area nurses that go out to all the outer islands and live and work in the primary health centres 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So as part of the staff health program, they also receive education on how to prevent getting mosquito bites and also to ensure that they're immunised against Japanese encephalitis if they're on the outer islands for longer than a month. So if they're out there for longer than 30 days on one of the outer islands, each healthcare worker receives the JE vaccine. Other diseases that we see quite commonly, also seen on the mainland, is outbreaks of varicella. Less commonly measles, but it does occur, predominantly again in unimmunised children that are coming down from Papua New Guinea. Pertussis, we have an Australian-wide epidemic of pertussis at present due to either laxed vaccination or older people where they've been vaccinated and now their immunity has waned. So we've got quite a big program in place in Australia to provide catch-up pertussis vaccination. We do see meningococcal every couple of months. Unfortunately, we had a child death recently in the community. And the reason I mention that is because it's a whole of community approach. So where it might be in other settings, particularly in tertiary settings where there's a relative amount of anonymity, here everybody is related to somebody and everybody knows everyone else's information, which poses a number of questions around how we manage staff and also our patients confidentially. With regard to meningococcal, we had several cases of meningococcal and unfortunately one death of a child. Because it's a whole of community approach, the community pretty much shuts down and goes into mourning. And that poses some problems about how we actually staff our primary health care centres and our health service at TI. It also hits the community fairly hard and also the healthcare workers that have developed close bonds with families of any child that's affected by disease and illness. Less commonly in the Torres on Thursday Island, but particularly in the teenage health sector where there's lots of problems, regarding STIs. So transmission of syphilis, chlamydia and gonorrhea is actually quite high in the district in a specific targeted population. And to try and counteract that, they promote healthy adolescent checks. And they, public health and health promotion will run several sessions to get teenagers in and have them checked and put them in a draw to win something like an iPod, which is a rarity up here. So it's something that's extremely well sought after. But there's also other incentives, for example, getting a $20 Australian card to spend on one of the shops locally. So there's a lot of health promotion that comes with some of these diseases. Just moving on to the next slide around common diseases that we see. I mentioned dental caries in children. It can go on to develop as rheumatic heart disease, which again is quite common in the Torres Strait. Children come in from the outer islands to board and go to school on TI. There's about 350 to 400 kids that attend a local high school here, and there's about 350 kids that attend two local primary schools. The Torres Strait Pagai School operates a fantastic education facility, and they have a number of kids that I mentioned come in to board. In that boarding centre, for example, where it houses 30 kids, at any one time, a quarter of the kids there might be affected by rheumatic heart disease. And this is generally picked up in the teen years, where they're having difficulties breathing or some chest pain, or they're unable to get around the sports field. Often it's too late to detect, but it's certainly monitored and they're given regular shots of bicillin when they come into primary health settings. Another common disease that we have up here in the tropics is acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis syndrome, which I'll talk a bit more about in a moment. Quite commonly we see multi-drug resistant TB, group A strep infections, community-acquired MRSA, scabies and Norwegian scabies and intestinal worms. So pretty much the first line of treatment for anyone presenting to one of the primary health centres is a good dose for the intestinal worms. And again, we aim to target education for the remote area nurses and health workers early as possible to allow appropriate identification and treatment of some of these cases. If left unchecked, it can be a fairly poor outcome for the child that's affected and also for the adult. With regard to community-acquired MRSA, in the Northern Territory and some parts of Western Australia and certainly in Northern Queensland, the rates of community-acquired MRSA are on the rise. I'm aware of the literature in the US around community-acquired MRSA and in various communities. We're working very closely with public health and health promotion to try and reduce some of the rates of community-acquired MRSA, and I'll go on to talk about why these sorts of infections are being seen quite regularly. So skin health is part of infection prevention and control, and as I mentioned, I work outside the hospital setting. Predominantly I am based in the acute health sector, but there is a frequent crossover to population health. Through skin health, the two flags there, the one on the left is the Aboriginal community and on the right is the Torres Strait community. And I mentioned the term deadly kids, so clean kids are good kids. And we advocate good skin health for all kids, also good oral hygiene and regular washing, bathing at home. The reason we focus on this is fairly simplistic, and obviously to prevent harmful bacteria from entering your body and keep the skin healthy by cleaning regularly and covering any sores with a band-aid and using insect repellent. We have lots of things that bite and pinch up in the Torres. The humidity during the wet season is around 95%. An average day up here would be between 30 and 40 degrees Celsius, so it's a very hot, warm, moist environment, and it provides the perfect environment for bugs to grow. Anybody who gets a cut or a bite from a bug needs to cover it immediately because there's plenty of flies that will take an interest. But also with regard to scabies, if scabies goes untreated, it can provide lots of opportunities for bugs to invade the skin and set up infections such as MRSA, Staph aureus and streptococcal infections. We definitely promote, you know, good healthy diet as well, and to have a regular intake of, you know, clean drinking water. just some examples on the screen about some of the infections that we see here. So the fairly innocuous scrape or graze on your knee the next week can turn into a great festering mess. So we do advocate covering sores and bites as soon as they occur and to seek medical advice or nursing treatment as soon as possible. Scabies is a particular problem in the Torres and also in Aboriginal communities, and it occurs in part because of overcrowding conditions. Almost second to the admission form, when patients come in, their skin is assessed and we look to see if they do have any signs of scabies. As I mentioned, the problem with scabies on the skin is that with persistent scratching, it can lead to skin breakdown and then subsequent infection with other bugs. It's not enough just to ask them if they've got scabies and to hand them a tube of cream. They also need to be educated in what to do with linen at home, about clearing out possibly some of the crowding conditions, and practicing good hygiene at home. We also need to ensure that they're able to apply the cream and that there's a family member that can assist them with that. Staph infections are very common, as well as school sores, and we also get the regular outbreaks of routine things that you see, particularly in childhood, such as hand, foot and mouth, pertussis and chickenpox. Cellulitis and boils is very common and often is the main cause of the person needing to attend emergency, where it's a boil or a bump or an abscess that's gone unchecked. And treatment needs to be sought as soon as possible. So we advocate that that the community regularly washes with warm soap and water. In some instances where we're looking to address community-acquired MRSA, we encourage them to use a Chlorhex or a triclosan at home, and also for family members to use a triclosan or Chlorhex. If necessary, family members are also encouraged to use mupirocin for decolonisation, but very much it's on a case-by-case basis. One of the unique things that we have in the Torres Strait is that healthcare workers that are providing direct care to patients are also the ones that are affected by some of these skin infections. So we have had some documented cases of transmission within family members in the community, but healthcare workers are also potentially passing it on in the workplace. And this affects the European population as well as the Torres Strait population. So we encourage families to look for sores daily and to cover them, use an antiseptic, and to get the health worker or the nurse to look at them as soon as possible. And also to sleep in a clean bed, wash the sheets and blankets regularly and air dry or put outside the mattresses. This becomes very difficult during the wet season, and we see a rise in gram-negative organisms during the wet season and a rise in gram-positive organisms during the dry season. It would be fair to say that on a good day here, without the wet season, but during our dry season, that there is winds of knots of 30 to 40, which also poses a number of problems with some of the organisms that are spread in the dirt that's picked up, and it's incredibly windy outside. We encourage the families to wash their towels and wash their clothes and change into clean clothes every day. Another important factor is the animals, and to encourage communities to keep the animals outside, but also to wash their dogs regularly. And if a dog is getting sick, to seek some advice about the management of the dog too. But wherever possible, keep the dogs out of the house. As I've mentioned, it's quite dirty and dusty up here at times. There has been some evidence to suggest that the transmission of community-acquired MRSA is occurring in WA and the Northern Territory because of the close communal living between humans and dogs. And we encourage the community to separate children from where the dogs are living or and sleeping. Overall, we're aiming to have healthy skin with the children, healthy families, healthy home and a healthy community. Just a little bit of information on acute post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, which some of you may have heard of. We've had a number of outbreaks. The most recent one up here was a couple of weeks ago. Before that, there was a big outbreak that occurred in 1993 to 94, and it was suspected that about 100 cases were known, but possibly there was more than that. Children were hospitalised for management of hypertension, and some because of encephalopathy and also acute renal failure. And there was two related deaths, both in Indigenous children. And public health had a big presence during that time and promoting good skin hygiene and also early recognition of the symptoms. In 2008, in August, there were three cases on TI. We follow up all cases and offer the family members prophylactic antibiotics, usually penicillin unless contraindicated. And over 600 children were followed up in that 2008 period. The signs and symptoms include hematuria, a BP that's higher than normal for children, swelling and puffiness, particularly of the face and maybe of both feet, and other symptoms may also include fatigue, irritability and pain over the kidneys. But long term, if untreated and unchecked, it can lead to kidney failure, and often the signs and symptoms can be absence in children. As they go on to mature, though, complete kidney failure may occur and they're required to then be dialysed. In the district at present, we're unable to dialyse patients. However, there is a new building, the Chronic Disease Centre, that's being constructed as I speak, where we will have 12 renal dialysis chairs that will be able to run two sessions a day. Apart from the normal comorbidities, we do have about 40% of our adult population is diabetic. About 30% of those are insulin dependent. In addition to that, the need for a dialysis centre is paramount. Many families need to leave the district and travel down to Cairns for treatment, which is quite inequitable health. So the Chronic Disease Centre aims to address some of those issues so that families can dialyse with their family members around them without having to travel great distances and relocate their house and their family to another district. For outbreaks of the APSGN, we declare an outbreak if there's three or more confirmed cases in 4 weeks and it's over the same geographical area. And we do clearly delineate what the roles are for public health and also for the community, and we certainly focus on a lot of health promotion during that time. Just another disease that I haven't mentioned as yet, but we see quite frequently during the wet season, is a disease called melioidosis, which is caused by Burkholderia pseudomeliae. Over a 5-year period, we've had 23 cases diagnosed in the region, which is the highest documented number, at least in Queensland. It occurs predominantly in this area because of the prevalence of diabetes, the high seasonal rainfall and the lifestyle of the Torres Strait Islanders, which includes getting in the water just about every day. When there is a king tide or a high tide here, which the ocean swells to 3 metres higher than the usual tide line, everybody goes swimming in the ocean. There's a lot of debris in the ocean. Presentations include community-acquired pneumonia or deep-seated abscesses, and in the last outbreak that we had, 22% of the cases died. So early detection and treatment is imperative. So just a little bit about the job. I've mentioned that we work very closely with public health. Quite frequently I go on the radio to talk about some of the diseases such as community-acquired MRSA, and depending on the time of year might talk about melioidosis, also talking about the importance of good food hygiene at home. There is quite a bit with regard to staff health, making sure that all our healthcare workers visiting the district and also those that live in the district permanently are covered against any vaccine preventable disease, and that they have a health check before they go onto the outer islands. With 22 sites in the Torres, it's quite a difficult job at times. A lot of the work that I do is via video conference, and up in the right hand corner there you can see some of our doctors are participating in video conferencing. So the main administrative hub is on TI, but the outer islands are able to dial in, push the TV and the camera over to the patient so that the doctors can adequately diagnose and give some initial advice before the patient, if necessary, is medevaced into TI. one of the biggest issues up here that affects some of the outcomes for any of the programs is attendance of the healthcare workers. Predominantly the health workers working alongside the doctors and the nurses are from the Torres Strait. You may recall earlier in the session I mentioned about the death in a community. The Torres Strait Islanders also have big tombstone openings, which occur usually 2 years after the date of a family member's death. During that time, it's actually a time for great celebration. And the Torres Strait Islanders traditionally have lived on the islands and using the sea as their primary source of food. Any given day for the Torres Strait Islander might be day to day. Today I'm going to go out and fish. Today I'm going to go and do go and dig in the garden for some food. And the work ethic is a little bit different to what the mainstream Australian population might be used to. It's not part of their culture to come to work 9 to 5. It's not part of their culture to plan days and weeks in advance. It's very much in the here and now. And on occasion, that provides significant difficulties to deliver effective health service in the absence of health workers. Also, the weather. The weather dictates the work, and what I mean by that is what we might see during a dry season, an increase in group A strep and Staph aureus infections, and in the wet season we might see melioidosis and gram-negative organisms. The weather also dictates our ability to get to the outer islands. In the wet season it rains like I have never seen rain before, and it rains for 3 to 4 months of the year. A lot of the islands are inaccessible during that time, or when we're flying out, we will get to the airport and be grounded and not going anywhere, or worse, we get stuck on one of the outer islands because we're unable to fly back due to poor visibility and atrocious weather. It also makes it very difficult for the people of the Torres Strait to get around. They don't fly around, they all own dinghies, and they island hop and they come into TI quite regularly. And that in itself poses some problems during bad weather, and that we will lose whole families to the ocean as the weather's particularly bad and they're trying to come into TI for whatever reason. So it's a significant impediment sometimes working in the district up here, but also it affects the structure of the hospital and the structure of the primary health centres. Some of the things that I do in infection control and hospital epidemiology here is the same as any infection control program, it just holds a different flavour. And public health is fairly dominant in that the group of activities that I might be doing on any one day. Some hospital acquired infection data from the Torres Strait Hospital is we are participating in the National Hand Hygiene Australia Initiative, which is part of the WHO Five Moments of Hand Hygiene Initiative. It was recently rolled out in Queensland. The national benchmark has been set as 65% compliance, and at present we're not doing so well in terms of 39% compliance with hand hygiene. So there's certainly a lot of education that needs to be done in this area, which also impacts on some of our infection rates. A few other figures for you. We do have a birthing suite here, and on occasion emergency cesarean sections are performed. The Torres Strait Islanders, pregnant women, come in to sit down, if you like, which is quite common in Aboriginal communities as well. So once they get to 36 weeks on the outer islands, they come in and are accommodated in one of the hostels for pregnant women. And as they get closer to their time, they have regular antenatal checks. One of the reasons that our cesarean section rate could be seen as quite high is because of the underlying comorbidities, which predominantly are obesity and diabetes. It also very much depends on the maternal age. We have some very young girls and we have some very old women that are delivering children. So the rate itself of 24%, you might think, well, that's quite high. However, this data is not risk adjusted. I haven't provided any confidence intervals because you could drive a truck through the confidence intervals on the small amount of data that's available. So we did about 30 caesars in 18 months, and following a retrospective review of those notes, we found about 24% infection rate, one deep that was quite significant, six superficial that resolved with oral antibiotics. In our retrospective review, we also looked at antibiotic prophylaxis and the appropriateness of the drug, whether they were given the right type of drug for the type of procedure. Also looked at the dose and the duration that didn't exceed 24 hours after the closure of the incision. I mentioned the community-acquired MRSA rates. 59% of all our Staph aureus isolates for the last 3 months have been community-acquired MRSA. So there are some significant interventions that are being planned for the whole of the district. TB is a particular concern for TI Hospital. We have two isolation rooms that at present are not adequately performing as isolation rooms. But we've got measures in place to improve and ensure that we meet appropriate standards for the isolation rooms. In the five-year review, we found that there was over 3,000 occupied bed days due to TB, and that 35% of those patients were actually multi-drug resistant TB. That has a big impact on our health service. Predominantly, the patients that are attending for TB treatment are from PNG. And where they're detected to have MDR-TB, their length of stay could be anywhere between 6 weeks to 6 months to ensure that there's compliance before they're transferred back to PNG. So it does have a significant impact on our ability to open up beds and bed blockages and bed closures as a result of TB patients. So on any given day, we might have 50% bed occupancy for TB patients. Something else that some of you may be interested in is our needle stick injury rates, which are quite high, depending on which way you look at it, but reported on 1,000 occupied bed days, so 0.65 to 1.76 incidents per 1,000 bed days. We average about 2 needle stick injuries a month. Now, I mentioned this, you might say, okay, well, that's fairly routine, but we do have retractable devices that we have put into most of the healthcare settings and a standardised impress list for what's available for consumables. One of the key problems that we face, though, is the remoteness of some of the outer islands, whereby if a nurse sustains a needle stick injury after hours, they do have an occupational exposure management pack that they follow that includes a pathology request slip and a workplace incident form. However, the closer the healthcare centres are to PNG, the more likelihood is that they are potentially exposed to HIV. Most of you would be aware that the optimum time period for AZT antiretroviral prophylaxis is within 2 hours of the exposure. It's physically impossible for the nurses to come in within that two-hour time period. So we do have AZT available to them on all the outer islands that is only given in conjunction with myself and the medical staff, and they're also provided, obviously, the normal counselling that goes with HIV, Hep B and Hep C testing. And it does pose a particular different issue, if you like, in getting the bloods in. It could take up to 48 hours to get a blood sample sent in to the TI pathology laboratory, just given the difficulties that we have with travel on occasion. So some of the challenges is the rotating staff, that no sooner have you trained up staff than the new ones have come on board. So wherever possible, I aim to have one-to-one sessions with staff, whether it's out on the ward or an ED, or a whole group of them will come to the office and receive one-to-one or one-to-five education before they actually start work. The geographical isolation does make it difficult on occasion to deliver effective healthcare in a timely manner. However, we do hopefully have ways around that. And a good sense of humour is imperative. There was an occasion where I needed to travel out to the outer islands in the wet season, where twice our plane propeller had failed to kick in, which didn't sort of bode very well for the rest of the trip. So you do need to have a good sense of humour. Try not to get too stressed in some of the situations, and there is quite a lot of air travel involved, so I wouldn't advise that if anyone was interested in working in areas such as this, if they don't like planes, if they don't like travel, if they're afraid of flying, this definitely is not the location for you. The weather poses all sorts of difficulties. It's very windy, lots of rain, but also it's very humid, and this poses some problems in the hospital setting with regard to mould. We have mold growing in the most unusual places. It's a very damp, humid environment. Mold also can cause potential problems in some of the asthmatics that we have, and also in keeping our sterile stock clean and free from contamination. So depending on the time of year, some of the issues are more challenging than others. Confidentiality is a big issue. Everyone is related to somebody else and everybody knows everybody. So I mentioned about the occupational exposure management. There's been instances where the recipient of a needle stick injury is actually the son and the source is the mother, and both of them are health workers working in primary health centres. So it's very difficult to navigate the normal processes and keeping confidential records and feedback of results, knowing that you're talking to families and one positive result can affect the whole family. Family structures are not to be underestimated. It's a really important part of my job, if I've learned nothing else, to be considerate of all people that I'm working with and to speak respectfully. If you fail to communicate effectively while working in a region such as this, you're doomed almost from the beginning, because there is certainly talk about who knows who and how well someone might be performing. So I always aim to communicate as effectively as I can and almost over-communicate in some instances, and try to ensure that everyone's hearing the same message at the same time. In a small community, there's often Chinese whispers, and I get some amazing calls about quite odd circumstances, misinformation and myths that exist. There's also black magic or folklore that exists in some part of the Torres. By and large, they're God-fearing people. That there's many, many churches on the island. There's 23 different denominations of churches. There is a little bit of black magic or folklore around, and a good example of that might be seasonal presentation of boils and bumps and lumps, where the elder Torres Strait Islander women will say, "Oh, it's spider bites," but they're assimilating the spider bites or the presence. They're assimilating the presence of spiders with the seasonal change. So they recognise changes in the season by what animals are doing. So the time that the spiders, small spiders, are everywhere is also the time that the dry season occurs, and this is the time when we see a peak in our community-acquired MRSA. The two don't actually have anything to do with each other, but through folklore, it will come about that the perception is that the small spiders are biting and causing these infections. Similarly, if someone fails to recover in hospital, there is some mystery about why that might be. The new hospital that's been built, that's only about 10 years old, has been built on a secret men's business site. The maternity unit has been built right over the top of that. And the locals would discuss some of the issues with that and how that actually makes pregnant women feel when they come into the healthcare setting knowing that it was on a men's business area that was designated on the island. Other challenges that we have, apart from communication, is the treaty zone and movement of PNG nationals between the two areas. We do have a strong immigration policy, and also we have customs staff and fisheries in attendance throughout the district. There's actually a lot of air traffic and a lot of boat traffic. We do have an agreement with the PNG government about treating patients as they come down into TI. However, it's not very sustainable as there's a growing need and a growing number attending for care. We're also unable to follow them up once they go back to PNG. So this is a particularly important area around multi-drug resistant TB and management. With regard to the primary health model of care, it's also at times very challenging to get some key messages across. My immediate focus is in the acute healthcare setting, but I work very closely with public health. Any message that I deliver regarding health needs to go through a primary health model and needs to be approved to ensure that it's culturally sensitive and appropriate. The built environment provides us with lots and lots of challenge. Maintenance of these areas is exceptionally difficult. The reason being is that it's quite difficult to get parts up here all our foodstuffs and most of our consumables, anything that you require up here, comes on barge from Cairns. It's a four-day barge where that's loaded up, usually on the Friday, and it arrives on the Monday where it's unloaded. If you are waiting for replacement pieces of equipment, specialised equipment to repair something, it can be quite a lengthy wait. It's also very expensive to get some of the items up here that we need. The built environment also provides us with significant challenge with respect to cleaning the environment. Some of the health centres are a little bit run down, but also because of the weather constantly pounding them and the humidity, it's quite frustrating for the cleaners to maintain a nice clean health centre. We also have some other issues in CSSD and theatre regarding the built environment and ensuring that it is kept at the right temperature in the wet season is almost impossible, and there's frequent air handling system failures. Our water supply, while relatively clean, is also heavily sedimented. We need to put inline filters on all water supplies that are used for medical treatments. We do have an issue with the vector-borne disease that I've discussed and also the respiratory disease, but the rain, humidity and the heat and wind certainly contribute to all of these diseases. Just a little bit on the role of health workers. We expect the health workers to work at an advanced level with moderate supervision. Most of them have gone down south to receive training and they've got sound knowledge of standards and practices, and I'm looking to work with health workers to apply some of the infection control skills by way of like a liaison nurse program, but so that there is someone at each primary health centre that has responsibility for management of an infection control program. They're expected to perform a range of tasks, and for some of them that might include immunisation, and they need to be fairly good at communicating and their interpersonal skills. The health workers actually have a lot of pressure placed on them because the majority of the time they're at a health centre where they're servicing their own family members. Family members can be very persuasive and will not stop at anything to get the best treatment they can for their family members. So it often puts our health workers in a really difficult position, particularly when it comes to confidentiality and record management, where family members might be demanding to know what the person's in hospital for or what they're attending the health centre for. This is just an example of some of our PHCs out at Mobiag. So Mobiag is an island where there's about 500 people that live there. Most of them look quite tropical. We've got a couple of islands such as Boigu, Duan and Saibai that are like a big mud flat, which also poses some challenges for access in the wet season where we can't actually get in there to work because of the mud. So access is certainly an issue, but also healthcare worker education and attendance. There is on most of the islands a permanent remote area nurse that works alongside a health worker to deliver health service for that particular island, but on occasion, whether it's funeral, illness, or it's just not a good day to come to work, the health workers are not always in attendance. So in summary, I'd like to thank you very much for listening to my talk today. I'd be happy to take any questions via email afterwards. There's probably some things that I could discuss further, for example, rates of infection. It's very much a public health talk, I guess. We have a very unique environment up here. The reason I moved up here is that I could combine my acute infection control skills with public health, but also it provides a great way of life for a young family. I have a 3-year-old and a 17-year-old daughter, so it's certainly provided some challenges in that respect too, and how they fit in with the Torres Strait Islander kids. We have quite a diverse setting up here, whereby you can swim in a magnificent ocean, but the ocean is full of sharks and crocodiles. So on that note, I'd like to close my talk, and I thank you very much for your attendance and participation today.
Thank you very much, Claire. I think that's fascinating. You've obviously got a huge job, but it is full of challenges. I have to say, when you mentioned crocodiles at the end of your talk, I'm quite glad now that I live in New Zealand and not in Australia. But it's quite interesting what you were saying about the community MRSA problems, which I heard were becoming more of a problem in parts of the Northern Territories. And I think a colleague came back from a conference a couple of years ago where they talked about putting in, I think in parts of the Northern Territories, they've put in swimming pools for the children.
Yes.
And that really
yes.
dramatically reduced the rate of boils and skin infections. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, they did that in the Northern Territory. Yeah. We've got a fantastic aquatic centre here, which is quite surprising. We also have a Montessori kinder, so there's some really surprising services that are on the island.
Mm-hmm.
We do encourage the kids to swim. They do swim in the ocean. The problem with the ocean, though, is that when it's really warm, the temperature of the ocean might be 27 to 30 degrees. If they've got cuts and bumps, it actually provides more of a breeding ground for some of the bugs. So we do prefer that they go and swim in the pool. And it's part of their culture, so they love swimming. They're in and out of the water
right.
all the time. But, yes, certainly in the Northern Territory, that's an initiative that's been introduced that has substantially reduced the rate of skin infections.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so it's a more chlorine-based swimming pool, basically, then.
It is. A more stable environment than the ocean.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much for that talk, Claire. It really is a fascinating topic. And I'd like to say again that I'm very happy to take any queries that you may have for Claire via my email address, which is on your slides, and I will certainly make sure that I'll pass them on to Claire. In closing, I'd like to thank Claire once again for her contribution to this year's teleclass series. Although it was postponed, it was certainly worth waiting for, so thank you very much for that, Claire. Thanks also to BD for their kind and generous sponsorship of today's lecture. And finally, thank you, the audience, for listening in, and goodbye for now.